Hello, good morning. You're very welcome to the program. Between now and nine, the Brewer's Castle in Mayo, Gas Men in Meath, detail on the derogation deal from the Minister in Limerick, the Artist and the Kilkenny River, and an unholy hooly in Tyrene. What do you call a tent full of happy farmers? Right now you're thinking that that's the start to a bad joke, and it could be. But this marquee of curious and optimistic farmers was an actual event that took place on Monday in Meath. The publicity launch of an anaerobic digester, which will be built by the middle
so
of next year.
For the invitation to be here with you today, and every success to all involved in this wonderful project.
Anaerobic digesters, big green bubbles you'll have seen mushrooming in the landscape. Grass and animal manure in, leave it ferment, stir it occasionally, and you get biomethane for energy and fertiliser for fields out. Real circular economy stuff. There are 20,000 of them across Europe. We only have two that are currently injecting gas directly into the grid. And the prospect of more is cheering news for farmers.
Then I have some land only a mile or two away.
You're in Tillage?
Yes.
Exclusively in Tillage?
Almost exclusively.
When was your last good year?
2022.
And before that, when was your last good
year? 1984. A long time ago.
You're laughing, but you're not laughing.
Well, I was always born to be a farmer, and I stick it through tin and tin.
You've had an absolutely horrible time of it in the last few years. So does something like this look like a bit of a runner for you?
Absolutely, yeah. Every little thing helps, and the more avenues we have to go down, the better.
Recent arrivals.
These are all spring-born calves. And they would have been born... Oh, sorry, autumn-born calves, apologies. They would have been born in August, into August, September.
Okay. And about 5 miles away from where a company called Carbon AMS is building that digester, Brua Duffy is farming 175 suckler beef cows. He also has a full-time engineering job off-farm. A busier man you will not find.
I'm not fixated on any particular breed. There's a mixture of Angus, Shorehorn, there's a few Limousine through it. There's cemental as well. We used to have a cemental bull. But,
and is it pros and cons with each, or do you have a favourite?
Easy calving is my number one rule. I haven't time,
no time for disasters.
Yeah, exactly.
It has to be simple.
Has to be simple as possible.
Are you calving here by yourself, bro?
Yeah, so I've cameras in the sheds. I can keep an eye on them when they're calving. I have an elderly uncle who I'm actually in partnership in this farm with, but he's 76, he's getting old. Yeah, it's tough.
Okay, it's not unmanageable, but like with
again,
hardship.
My wife will tell you yes. Yeah, it's difficult. I'm not going to pretend it isn't.
Something had to change, so he plans to pivot his farm in the direction of much, much less cattle and supplying grass and maize to the digester instead, for which he will receive a guaranteed price agreed at the beginning of the year. Win. Win, win. So it must seem, frankly, just an awful lot more philosophical sitting there on your house on the hill watching grass grow and knowing that that's going to be your business from now on.
Yeah, well, like cattle are hard work. There's no two ways around it. And it can be very frustrating sometimes knowing that you're going to work and you haven't done things properly or you might, I need to spend another hour or two there and you just physically can't. So I'd like to think, right, if we can reduce the demand on the cattle bit and, like, I just want to do things properly. Do it right. Do it the way I know it should be done.
But because nothing is ever simple when it has the chance to be complicated, there is a bit of a wrinkle in this. The goal the government has set for biomethane means that 120,000 hectares of grass will have to go into the anaerobic digesters. That's 170 Phoenix Parks. Or 3,500 average-sized farms. Is there enough spare grass in the country? In Northern Ireland, they already have 60 anaerobic digesters, and arguably that's too many clustered too close to each other because they can't produce enough grass all year round to supply them. So much so that you will regularly see trailer loads of grass leaving Meath and Louth and heading across the border. There's a document circulating behind the closed doors of government that would answer that question. Do we have enough grass for 100 large digesters that we want to build? The document is called the Land Use Review Report, but for over a year now, the government has deflected or ignored all calls to publish it.
We have massive opportunities with regard to further AD plants and biomethane in this country. We haven't delivered at scale heretofore. But
back at the launch of the anaerobic digester in Meath, I tried my luck with Minister Dara O'Brien, who I know has a copy of the report.
But what's great about this is it's a further assistance in creating sustainable energy ourselves, decarbonising our heat system.
This is only one of 95 or 100 more to be built.
Yes.
And people are asking themselves, where is all of the grass going to come from?
Not being facetious, but just look around. Like, I'm from North County Dublin, born and reared here. Duleek is just up the road from me. You'll see we've some of the best grasslands and agricultural lands in the country. It is also complements crops such as our potato crops. The cycle is correct within that as well. So you'll have land under grass, then it'll be planted for potatoes and other crop as well.
You could answer that question, though, about where all of the grass is going to come from with an awful lot more confidence if the land use review was something that was out there in public circulation and your department has been sitting on it for over a year now.
Just to correct you, respectfully, I haven't been sitting on it. I received the report in July of this year. It's three departments. It's my own, it's Agriculture, and it's the Department of Housing, Planning and Local Government. I actually said in response to a question in the Dáil the week before last that I want to publish before Christmas. It's a really good piece of work. And I agree with you that it's important that it's published, that it's out there and people can see the report itself, but more importantly, what comes from it.
500,000 acres of afforestation, 68,000 acres of solar power, 120,000 acres of grassland for anaerobic digesters and so on and so on. Does it answer that question that there is enough land for all of these activities and all of these targets we've set ourselves?
Well, I think people will see the report and assess it when it's published, and I do want to publish before Christmas, but yes, it deals with various scenarios as well. It's not just within my gift to publish it, I'd say as well. There are two other government departments as well involved.
Well, they're deferring to you when I write to them.
I can actually tell you that I want to publish before Christmas, and I intend that it will be. And I think, in fairness, it can provide a good roadmap for us into the future.
It is going to be very important. It'll tell us, if we continue doing dairy and beef and tillage at present levels, how much room is left for all of the digesters and turbines and forests and rewetting and restored nature that we've also promised that we're going to do. Or will some things have to make way for other things? So you can see why it's going to be potentially controversial. And for some of the farmers in the tent on Monday, a different kind of farming now looks like a much better bet.
Hopefully it'll make us a little more profitable, give us more diversification of the crops we're going to grow and see how that goes. But yes, I'd like to be a potential customer.
And it would be nice to have that certainty that you say, look, if I do maize, four Donald's,
yes,
anaerobic digester,
yes,
well, at least I know I'm going to get this price by the end of the year for
us. Yes, it's great to have. My bank manager would just love predictability, so that would be just wonderful.
An upbeat and happy sounding tillage farmer, an unusual sound on this programme in the last few years. So, do we have the room to do everything? There are some calculations out there that say we're going to need four whole new counties to fit all of these activities in. Four counties the size of Wicklow, Wexford, Kildare and Dublin. So, big changes ahead in the landscape. So you can see why that land use review document is going to be a very, very important start to that conversation. What understanding or relationship with the landscape would you have if you were partially sighted or even fully blind? Cork artist Claire McLaughlin set up a project named Seen Unseen over 10 years ago to facilitate access to arts and to cultural experiences for people living with sight loss. Earlier this week, Claire and her group of blind and partially sighted people visited the Meath racing yard of Cheltenham winning trainer Gavin Cromwell to get up close to horses and to experience them at work out on the gallops just a few miles from the Hill of Tara. Suzanne Campbell was there to experience the yard with them through touch, smell and sound.
Can anyone smell the horses?
Yeah.
That was the first thing they said when they got off the bus.
Even off the bus you could smell the horses, could you? Yeah. Because we're so used to them, we don't. But you know when you go to the zoo and you smell the elephants and that?
Yeah.
That's probably the same here, is it?
Not as bad.
There's horses on both sides of you now, and they're about, they would be well over your head. See, can we get one to put their head out now and we'll get them, let you pet them. This guy has his back to you. He's leaning up against the door. He's having a scratch. That's his bum there, if you want to just touch his bum. He won't kick. Does anyone want to feel his tail?
Yeah, I just want to feel.
Years ago, they used to make mattresses out of this.
Really?
Horse hair.
Yeah.
Do
you want to
feel
his tail, John?
Yes.
Come over here to me.
Yeah,
no,
thank you.
Oh,
hello.
It's quite coarse, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it's quite strong, yeah. Absolutely. Nice and tactile.
Yeah.
Good Lord, it's hard, isn't it?
Isn't it? Very hard.
Very wiry.
Yeah, very wiry.
You'd imagine it'd be a bit softer, wouldn't you?
Well, when it's brushed, on race day now, it would be a lot softer. We'd put a silicone onto it and it brushes out really soft.
Hello. Oh, I like you too. Huh?
You're giving your face a good sniff.
He's having a check out there.
Yeah, I like you too. You're beautiful.
So the first lot is in the warm-up arena for 7 o'clock. The boys are here about 10 to 7. And then they ride out till 1 o'clock. So every horse will get exercised. You know, we could have anything up to 8 or 9 lots on a busy day.
Do you ride them all out every day?
Most of them will ride out, yeah. Oh, they'll get exercise of some sort.
So we'll just go out to the gallop and we'll do a bit of a warm-up first and then we'll just do two canters on the gallop and that'll be just it.
How many have you ridden today?
We have ridden 4 already, so this is our fifth lot.
Fifth lot, okay.
So 4 more to go.
And do you know this lad well?
I know him well enough, yeah.
Is he quiet?
He can be a bit quirky, like.
Quirky. He's one of our better riders, so he's got some more awkward ones.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like surround sound for anyone, obviously, who's fully blind, or for myself, who's partially sighted or vision impaired. You're getting a 360 nearly, and you can hear them going back. Hearing, and for myself, seeing them going through the water down south, just down there, just to cool down. Lovely sounds and very sensory driven. Very good.
Bernie, are you enjoying this? The horses are racing by.
I can hear them, yeah. They're going so fast I can't see them.
I can barely see them, if that's any help.
I can hear them.
Absolutely ripping past.
Ah, lovely animals.
So the project, the Seen Unseen project, sort of opened the doors to galleries and things like this, where we get to experience it by means of audio and touch and description and smell. And then, of course, we have a bit of crack as well. So all of a sudden, the world is available to us and we experience it, you know?
Well, Seen Unseen now is a particular project. It's about access. So Seen Unseen Goes Racing is a collaboration with Horse Racing Ireland. Mm-hmm. So we've gone to the Curra and we've gone to John O'Donoghue's yard. Now today we're in Gavin Cromwell's yard, award-winning Gold Cup trainer. And on Saturday we're going to Fairy House.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Have you been racing before, Carmen?
Yes, I've been to the Curra. We've had a trip to the Curra.
Yeah. Did you enjoy that?
A few years ago, yeah. We loved it, yeah, we loved
it. And when did you lose your sight?
Slowly, gradually. I've got RP, retinitis pigmentosa.
Okay.
And so it happened gradually, slowly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you were a fully sighted person?
I even used to drive.
Okay, right.
I used to drive. And then when I was 25, I found I had to stop driving because I couldn't handle it. And in the dark, it's too dark. And, you know, then realise I can't drive anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What do you think of the yard here today?
Absolutely fabulous. The minute we arrived, we could smell the horses, and one of them there was very friendly and curious.
Yeah,
he wanted to lick all of us. Yeah. Get to know all of us.
So and, sweet.
And then as well you hear the horses clip-clopping. Yes. In and out, yeah, which yes. is lovely. That sound is gorgeous. It's a very sensory experience. Sighted people actually lose a lot by not engaging all of the senses. We definitely lose a lot.
That's so true.
Yeah. You know?
Our other senses sort of become enhanced, so we can smell more and remember more, but we'd remember what we heard, not what we saw.
Or what you felt.
And
yeah.
what we felt. Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. yeah.
Our riders tend to use their own saddle. No, they do in a race because they have to carry a certain weight,
yeah.
but not for during exercise. No, they all have the same saddle, same type of saddle.
And are they all made of leather?
Some of them are actually PVC, but yeah, the better ones are actually leather.
Yeah, I really appreciate you having us down, Gavin. Absolutely, yeah, really do appreciate it.
It's nice to have a different group interacting with the horses.
It is, absolutely, very interesting, and it's educational for us, I think, really.
The sounds and the tactileness, we sometimes forget about that.
Yeah, this lady was feeling the horse's tail, and it was, I think the tail was dirty, and the difference in that and when it would be clean, and
yeah.
you know, simple little things that you never think about.
You wouldn't think about, yeah.
I think as well, in the visual world, people genuinely forget, or because they're not exposed to, you know, it's like vision impairment or disability in general.
Yeah.
If you don't know about it, or you don't know someone with it, they don't really get it until they're sort of immersed in it in a way. And like today, we get to hear the sounds around and then see, for the people who can see what we can make out. It puts us on the same track, pardon the pun, as a sighted community.
Sound, touch, smell and taste, because that is a carrot being eaten by a horse. You heard the voices of trainer Gavin Cromwell and assistant Pat Martin, work writer Shane Fitzsimons, and from the Seen Unseen group, artist and organiser Claire McLaughlin, John Ryan, Bernie Kenny and Carmen Miller. Suzanne Campbell reporting. And they are all, excuse me, heading off racing today to the first day of the Winter Festival at Fairy House. The best of luck to Gavin Cromwell and his team at Damestown and all of their connections for their runners there today. Now, back to that theme of leaving a mark on the landscape. Stay, change or go, the nitrates derogation is definitely going to leave its stamp on the land. Keep it as it is, say the scientists, and we will undoubtedly degrade life in rivers in the catchments of the free draining soils of the south of the country. Lose it or alter it, and we will push many of the 7,000 farms in derogation into severe financial distress. And as our reporting on Countrywide has shown in the last couple of months, this is really difficult because both of those arguments about water quality and financial viability are both true. On Thursday, our EU Commissioner Michael McGrath said that the Commission had decided to retain the derogation, but that he could offer no detail on whether or not it would be altered. Well, dairy farmers met last night in Limerick at the ICMSA AGM, and as the meeting closed, I nabbed the Agriculture Minister, Martin Hayden, in a very noisy room. I apologise for that, but I nabbed him to try and find out what, if any, promises he has had to make in order to get the Commission's backing for a renewal of the derogation.
Hey, Philip.
You step in behind here, it might be the easiest thing to do. Now, fluid and dynamic process, this whole nitrates derogation decision, I appreciate that, but what can you tell farmers who are listening very anxiously right now to this about where that decision is at?
So I can tell them that the process has advanced significantly after an awful lot of negotiations and very close collaboration with Commissioner Roswell. We got agreement last week that the Commission would put forward a proposal to the Nitrates Action to the Nitrates
Committee,
which is a technical committee. They meet on the 9th of December. ultimately, it is each of the member states' representative on that committee that vote to decide whether we get the proposal or not. We needed a commission to make the proposal. That was a big step, but it's not complete. We don't have the derogation unless that committee approves that on the 9th of December. But the proposal is that Ireland would have an extension of the existing derogation with certain conditionality for another 3 years.
And that conditionality is what people want to know about. The Habitats Directive in particular, how is that being stitched into this deal?
So, look, this is a process that isn't finished yet, and I want to be very careful that I don't undermine the work of that committee. I had a clear plan around how I was going to communicate this. I want to recognise the role that the farming organisations, that industry, that all the key stakeholders have played and been really responsible to give me the space to do these negotiations. So that conditionality I can't crystallise right now.
Okay, fair enough.
But what I can say in terms of the Habitats Directive, absolutely, we committed last summer when this was a red line for the Commission that for these negotiations to be successful, we had to address the Habitats Directive and our compliance with it in more detail. I committed to that over the summer, and we've worked through the detail of what that might look like, and that's why we've got the proposal of 3 years, because I've made it really, really clear that we will need 3 years in which to carry out
there will be assessment at a catchment level. Is that going to place any obligation on farmers, they will want to know, or is that something that ecologists, officials working on behalf of the department can carry out?
No, I've said very clearly that my department will take this on at a catchment and a sub-catchment basis, such as the importance of the derogation for our country, and that we need the time to do that. That involves the hiring of a lot of ecologists and a process to be worked through on that regard. We don't start that recruitment process until we've got the approval and that we have the derogation.
Okay, but no additional burden to farmers here?
No, in terms of farmers, it's a process that we have to work through.
Any other additional conditionality you can tell us about, like a further reduction in nitrates level?
So that, I can't go through that detail. Look, I have a process here, okay. And my intention was really clearly to be really responsible on this, not to undermine the role that committee has, because that result is the most important. And I also need to have a process here where I inform Cabinet of this detail first.
And not countrywide, fair enough.
So, okay. But you know, happy to go on countrywide in time and discuss this in real detail.
But
then,
the next stage in that process then is this committee meeting on the 9th of December. Have you any reason to believe that there are countries that would oppose this proposal?
Not as of now, but I'm not taking anything for granted. It is a technical committee. Ireland is represented on that by one of my key officials, and every member state has a representative on that, and they will look at this in technical detail. And what I am making myself and my officials available, that if any member state should have any queries on the technical elements of this proposal, we stand ready to engage with them, to talk to them. I'm leaving no stone unturned, and I'm not in any way, I don't want to in any way undermine that process. It is a process that they have to go through in their own deliberations.
No doubt the scientists on that committee would say, look, the key issue here is the number of animals out at pasture is what is causing the lion's share of the problem, which you can't address and improve water quality until you address head on the number of animals. Are you going to do that?
So what they will look at is the right action in the right place at the right time, which is what this is all about. And the measures our farmers are taking, the extra conditionality that they're signing up to and have signed up to previously to be a derogation farmer. And what they also will look at is, why is Ireland the only country left with this application? That in January we could be the only country in all of Europe to have this exemption from the European rule, because our farming system is very different. Our pasture base is different, the amount of rainfall that falls here is different, we have denitrifying soils, and therefore we are not the same as other European countries. So it's not just about the amount of animals standing on an acre of ground. It's actually about, where is that acre of ground? What is that ground like? What's the soil like under it? What's the ground like? What's the sky like over it? How much rain falls on that? That soil's ability to sequester and to take up nitrogen and other elements, and what are the measures farmers are taking to help in that process as well. It is a very broad, complex area.
But you can't solve that water quality issue with the herd the size that it is in those areas of free-draining soil, can you?
There's different elements here. The Habitats Directive is different to water quality. There are mitigation measures you can bring into place. There is the additional measures that farmers are taking. We're innovating our farming systems all the time. Our farmers are farming really differently now than they were a generation ago, and that is going to continue. And you see that those farmers are being supported through my department, through our TAMS grants, really lucrative grants there to help increase nutrient storage, adoption of low emission slurry spreading, a range of different measures. Farmers are supported on this journey because the work to do is so important.
If you're a lucky man, you're still going to be the Minister for Agriculture in 3 years' time. You might be unlucky, though, that you're going to be dealing with this trauma all over again. Are we not just pushing the cliff edge 3 years down the road?
No, absolutely not. What I'm providing, look, there's never full certainty. The only full certainty I could give derogation farmers was not to have a derogation in January. But this isn't kicking the can down the road. And when I'm able to go through the detail of the process in more detail afterwards, people will see clearly that this is a roadmap to provide more certainty into the future.
Would you have preferred if Commissioner McGrath hadn't broken this news in the way that he did on Thursday?
It's fair to say my day yesterday was different than I planned when I got out of bed. But look, and what was really important, once one element of it was referenced, I needed farmers to know that that was a three-year proposal, because that uncertainty. But look, I do want to recognise there's a lot of sensitivity in this. This isn't done until the 9th of December. I'll be a happy man when we get to the 9th of December and this is done and dusted.
Agriculture Minister Martin Hayden. So to sum it up there, there was a trade-off or a deal done with the Commission that there would be appropriate assessment of farming impact on the land to comply with the Habitats Directive in exchange for their support for the derogation. But it is going to be the department that will do that at the level of a river catchment, and farmers won't have to do it at the level of their farm. But the big question, will the same amount of nitrate be going on the land? We won't know that until the 9th of December. The Taoiseach, who was also there at the ICMSA AGM, did say that it was his intention that farmers would be farming at 220 on January the 1st and January the 2nd, and that there was going to be no cliff edge. But we will have to wait and watch this space. More changes afoot in the landscape after the break.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
Just a little bit after 25 to 9 on your Saturday morning. Well, in this big conversation to come about how we use the land, we're going to have to remember to make space for rivers that will, from time to time, be a very destructive force. This is a theme that preoccupies Kilkenny artist Bernadette Kiley. A lot of her work captures the shifting balance between water and land and those on its edges. From her home on the banks of the River Nore in Kilkenny, she has observed how a river carves out both the landscape and our sense of ourselves. This is the theme of her new exhibition, Rivers of No Return. Della Kilroy took a walk along the riverbank with Bernadette.
Well, we're walking along by a tributary of the River Nore, and it used to be called the County Home Stream. So it's quite narrow, it's quite volatile. I'll call it a raggedy kind of a stream. It's not cultivated in any way, which is great. So it's very natural, very organic. Just trees, ivy, everything growing. And often birds singing in the springtime as well.
I'm in Kilkenny's Thomastown with artist Bernadette Kiley. She moved here over 30 years ago and has since been documenting the impact of water on daily life. Her practice is grounded in slow observation, walking the River Nore, listening to it and tracing its presence, something she's been drawn to all of her life.
Well, I grew up in Carrick-on-Shore, County Tipperary. And for the first 10 years, we lived right on the river, on the quay. And my mother actually told me that she thinks the first thing I saw looking out the window, they had a top flat, was a flood when I was about 3 months. I suppose I would have been immersed in the river. We went swimming and I would have seen a lot of flooding from when I was a child. So I was always attracted to rivers. I don't know, I'm almost compelled by rivers because they're so magical, so beautiful, but also so destructive. You know, so there's that constant duality. And also there's metaphors for life and going with the flow and all that kind of thing attached to rivers, you know, and endless poems written about rivers and the beauty and everything. But it's more, in a way, the destruction I'm drawn towards because of the realization of, I suppose, how destructive rivers can be.
So where are we walking to now?
We're walking into a tiny little wood. It's like a secret little fairy wood, but it's just beside the road, and it's just like a magical little area, isn't it? And little pathways walking along. It's covered in ivy and just wild trees. When you can hear the river, it's gurgling, kind of, it's very fast moving. I don't think I've ever seen this going slowly or even stopped. You know, it always seems to be moving. It's quite unseen, very off the beaten track. And the presence of water has a huge effect on people's mental health. And you don't have to swim or anything, just to be beside it and just sit beside it and just look at it. It does something to you, doesn't it? I have to say, if I lived away from water, I think I wouldn't be happy.
How big of an influence has it been?
It's probably been a lot bigger influence than I even realise. I started to draw images of the river when I moved here. So I never really saw it as a document of the river, but because I've been doing it for so long and so frequently, it's become that. It's kind of a big part of my life, and I see it all the time and I look at it all the time.
We're walking along where you walk along this stretch of the river every day. What changes in the environment have you noticed here over the past few decades?
It's mainly from the flooding point of view. It's unpredictable and it's volatile, but I have noticed the weather changing. And I mean, the prediction, climate scientists, you know, warmer and wetter, we can feel that. And we've had a lot of flooding. You know, I mean, we even had a flood 3 days ago. Like how the water affects land and people is one of my big interests. And also water staying high for longer, you know, and just being there for months and months and months. So we're going to walk up the quay now on the right-hand side, heading towards the town of Thomastown. And my house and studio is more or less halfway up the quay.
Overlooking the river, Bernadette's studio on the quayside is where she paints, draws and documents the river's changing surface.
We're in my studio and there's a lot of oil paints lined up there and there's loads of brushes and there's loads of photographs of images of flooding and from all over the world.
How do you think rivers can shape identity as well?
Well, I do think they do shape our identity. There was a bunch of friends, you know, living here a while ago, and we used to call ourselves river livers. And of course, Ireland is full of rivers, and we all identify very much with rivers. And they're very important to us. And I'll just say the name of the exhibition that we're going in to see is Rivers of No Return, I called it, because I just kind of thought about the idea of that river is passing by us now and we'll never see it again. So it's imperative that we look after it.
Bernadette's latest exhibition is on the river's edge in the heart of Kilkenny City. It reflects the river's changing face, from the force of flooding to the fragility of its ecosystem.
We're here in the tea houses on the edge of the river. So we're looking here at, based on our depicting, is the River Nore from my house in Thomastown. So we're looking at a painting of a rat surrounded by mucky water. One time during a flood, I was walking along the quay in my bare feet and the water was up to my knees. And I met somebody coming down, a man, and he said, you know, you shouldn't be walking in your bare feet because the rats are everywhere. And of course, I should know that because we see a lot of rats beside the river, you know. This is a rat that looks actually quite happy in his natural environment. So I think what has happened over the number of years that I've been exhibiting these works is that it has kind of brought it home to people that this is actually reality. And so I think art actually is unique in that it can convey that, you know, whereas other media can't.
Isn't that interesting? The climate changes, so the rivers change, our relationship with the rivers change, and we change as a consequence. Bernadette Kiedy talking to our Della Kilroy. Rivers of No Return is the exhibition. It's in Thomastown. 51551 for your texts.
Tom says, hi Philip, can those anaerobic digesters handle slurry? If so, wouldn't this be a great way of reducing effluent leaking into streams? Tom, they can handle slurry, but there's more energy generated from the grass than there will be from the slurry. But yes, you're right, there will be a lot of slurry diverted to digesters rather than having to spread on the land. And Peter asks, Philip, using grass to create gas to generate electricity to power data centres while importing soy to feed the cattle whose grass is diverted to the digesters seems like a very perverse version of circularity. Good point, Peter. Okay, back to the landscape and big houses in the landscape. What do the following have in common? Ivy House on St. Stephen's Green, Lugalaw in Wicklow, Farm Lee in Phoenix Park, Ashford Castle in Mayo, Luttrellstown Castle in Dublin. All were at various points in Irish history owned by members of the Guinness Brewing Dynasty. Stately homes, country hideaways, townhouses, they amassed a vast property portfolio. And with the Netflix series House of Guinness stimulating interest in the family, historian Adrian Tinniswood has produced a very timely, very handsome book called The Houses of Guinness. See what he did there? I met Adrian in the grounds of Ashford Castle, inherited in the 1860s as a holiday home by Arthur Edward Guinness, who preferred to go by the name Lord Ardilaun. Ashford Castle, County Mayo, not what they said on Netflix.
We must begin work on all of these places we didn't know we had. We ask Anne to visit the properties, starting with the castle in Galway.
It was a hunting lodge. It was a country house. A country house that had fallen on bad times. It was not derelict, but it was not in a good state when the Guinnesses bought it in the 1850s. Okay. It was mortgaged up to the hilt. And then the Guinnesses came, and they just transformed it. They extended it. The story is that Lord Ardilaun, who's the Guinness who really did the work here, that he spent nearly £2 million on it.
Have you done the maths on that? Have you any idea how much we're talking about?
Maths are not my strong point, Philip, but we're talking hundreds of millions. Hundreds of millions. But one thing that historians like me often forget, you know, having a lot of money is good fun. It's really good fun. And he had a lot of money.
I will pay your father's debts. And you will get an annual income of £10,000.
15. 12.
15 it is.
Arthur! In that case, proposal accepted.
Controversial statement. I've always thought that Ashford Castle was a little bit ridiculous, frankly, with all of its battlements and ramparts and castellation. This was a bit Disney before Walt Disney came along.
What Lord Ardilaun said was, I have a taste for the picturesque.
The picturesque.
The picturesque. And he liked to add a tower here and there, you know, battlements. He just, it was a fantasy. It was a play thing. I mean, he never lived here particularly. Yeah. This is a guy, I said he's rich. He has an enormous mansion at Clontarf, St. Anne's. He's got a house on Leeson Street. He's got he and his wife have got Macross in Kerry. They've got Macroom in Cork. He's got a house on Carlton House Terrace in London. And he's got this place to play with. This is a toy for him.
What he made, though, was perhaps a little bit more grandiose than grand. Would that be fair? What does it say to us about what kind of person he was?
It says, I think, that he was socially ambitious. And it also says that his wife, Olivia, who we tend to forget, was very socially ambitious. I mean, she's the daughter of an earl. She's the daughter of the Earl of Bantry. And that meant that she had kind of plans for moving up the social scale.
Edward doesn't understand the complex nature of modern politics. He wants me to be elected to Parliament so I can help run the business. He is concerned I might lose.
Edward, his name is Guinness and this is Dublin. Of course he won't lose.
Would they have been thought of as vulgar, as a little bit nouveau back then, or were they just doing what the establishment did with their money?
That's a tough one. I think that the marriage to an earl's daughter brought them into the kind of mainstream, brought them into high society. And also having such a colossal amount of money meant it was quite dangerous to call them nouveau riche.
<You know? laughs> A little touch of lese majeste about
it. Exactly.
But, you know, when he was ennobled, he chose his own name, Ardilaun. Ard Ilon, yeah. High Island.
Yeah.
Yeah, that suggests to me that the fella had notions about himself.
Well, it's named after here as well, the High Island. You know, it's Ardilaun, and he's Lord Ardilaun of Ashford, he called himself, you know. So he got this sense. The guy has got, he's got 20-odd thousand acres of Galway and 4,000 acres of Mayo here. I mean, he's a major, major landowner.
Major landowner, yeah.
We were too weak to dig graves. And they gave us seed from the parish in 48, but we were so hungry, we cooked the seed. There's nothing left to plant. We had nothing left for rent.
So talk to me about the relationship between landlord and his tenants here. It's quite nuanced, isn't it?
It's nuanced and it's fraught as well, I think. You know, there were bad landlords, because this was a poor part of the world, of course it was. There were bad landlords and there were good landlords. And there were landlords like Lord Ardilaun, who was somewhere in between. You know, he was firm but fair. He was a good landlord, in fact. He was, you know, he remitted his tenants' rents when times were hard. He paid something like £3,000 worth of meal and seed for them. But he was also, he didn't book any opposition at all.
Yeah, because when the Land League came along with its campaign of rent strikes, he had such deep pockets, he was able to resist it, wasn't he?
He was, and that really kind of annoyed the Land League, I think. You know, it didn't matter to him if he didn't get the rent. It really didn't. But you've got, I mean, the unrest around here. Viscount Mount Morris is murdered close to here. Lord Ardilaun's bailiff, two bailiffs were killed when they tried to evict some of his tenants. You know, there's violence here. George Moore, who was a guest... after his own estates kind of came under threat from the Land League, he was a guest here, and he joked about how at breakfast he could hear explosions going off, and that's because Lord Ardilaun's workers were digging a moat. Lord Ardilaun said that he would put cannon on the bridge here, and of course it was a joke, but there were death threats.
So maybe all of these ridiculous battlements and castellation does actually reflect something of a mindset, a siege mentality.
That's a really interesting point, because certainly you can see in England in the early 19th century a lot of castles being built as industrial unrest is growing. And they're not really defensive structures. Like, this isn't really a defensive structure, no. But it's expressing a state of mind, maybe.
Now is the time for us seniors to use that weakness and free Ireland from the English!
What did you make of the Netflix series? Did it offend you as an historian, or were you able to enter into the spirit of it?
It started off offending me. It started off... historians are cursed, you know, with historical dramas like that, saying, oh, that didn't really happen, it wasn't like that. It's like, you know, the Benjamin Lee's funeral, you know, the Fenian riot, which is ridiculous. But the trouble is, as you watched it, I got drawn in. I mean, it's terrible history, but it's really good TV.
I think, in fairness to it, does it not say from the very beginning, look, we're history adjacent here?
It's fiction inspired by true events, I think they say, which is fine, except that the viewer goes away not knowing which is which.
It inspired me to pick up your book and learn a little bit more. So
In that case, it succeeded.
I was just going to say, it would be a little bit rude of you to be offended by it.
Absolutely right. Now I'm just grateful, right?
You can correct me if I'm wrong, but this is where Joe at the front door told me Lord Ardilaun would sit and read his papers in this little snug.
It's not true at all to people.
Is it not?
I don't know. But
looking out over that view, you can see why the fella had notions, can't you?
Absolutely. There is a joy in owning and building, which I think is exciting, and which, to be honest, we often forget. So Desmond Guinness, who, you know, almost single-handedly started the Irish conservation movement, I mean, he was one of the first to say, don't regard these things as symbols of colonial oppression. Regard them as things of beauty. You know, as the French did after the French Revolution with Versailles, as the Russians did after the Russian Revolution with Katrinburg. You know, places like these are astonishing monuments. They're monuments to a privileged life. They're monuments to a wealthy life, but they are monuments. They're part of Ireland's history. And without them, Ireland would be a greyer place.
Adrian Tinnis would there. I learned an awful lot from that man on that day in Ashford Castle. The Houses of Guinness by Adrian Tinnis would. It really is a lovely, very, very well produced book. And also a useful fact check to the Netflix series House of Guinness. Now, finally this morning, there was a bit of correspondence from Keith Brennan in our mailbox this week. He was at a bit of an unholy hoolie in Tyrene Hall in Mayo, a music and dance event. Gralton Big Band supplying the music, Edwina Guchian, who else, leading the dancing.
The barking November cold of Tyrene, County Mayo, I hear it before I see it. The rattle and hum snakes its way to me down Main Street. I follow the sound, slide in through double doors. The hot breath and the roar of the room roll past me into the cold. Amongst hups and roars, fiddles, banjo and accordion saw at the air. 200 souls circle one another on the dance floor, flow around themselves and each other as a rhythm gathers to a sprint. Above me, beside the door, projected under the sweat-dripping wall. The dance hall door is the gate of hell, and too many are queuing to enter. A woman hitches up the sheath of her dress, pulls up a stocking and steps back into the circling crowd. Her husband or partner, or just for the night, or it could be either one or all, slides in beside her. Afterwards, she sits beside me. Are you a matchmaker? No, I'm a writer. You'd have work tonight, boy, if you were, but you might fill a book too. I ask what tonight means to her. She stands, arms out wide to the floor, in the crease of mouth and eye, both triumph and grief. They taught us to be ashamed of our bodies, but look at what we have done. Look where we are now. They watch the circling throng of the crowd for a space to slot back in and are gone. Mid-set, a guard comes to break up the dance and fetch his daughter, a daughter trying to escape from the gravity of church and state. He barges through, battering a milk can to arrest the dance, roars at the crowd, Eileen! Music spills to a ragged stop. The sound now, two people's hearts breaking one another as they circle each the other. The crowd gathered close around the two actors. He cajoles. If I change, will you stay? He turns bitter, cloaks regret and threats. Is this who you choose? Protestants, good-for-nothing musicians. Eileen, you'll not beat me or defeat me. You could touch the ice that ripples in the crowd. They break in. Let her go. Leave her be. Let Eileen alone. Old stories that shape the world we dance from are now at the heart of the hall. The ghosts are invited in. For a moment, we look at one another across the dance hall divide. The Ireland that was, the Ireland that is. And the music strikes again, people flurry into couples, the crowd fill the hall with themselves. A 70-something-year-old man in the corner stands, white hair, cap in hand, while talking to a friend, catches the swing of the music and pours the rhythm through his body as he chats. He is dapper, bright-eyed, has practiced grace, entirely alive in the swell of the sound. How can you tell the dancer from the dance? Never should, never could. Some tried to leave her both apart. In Tyrene, they never really did.
Keith Brennan was at Edwina Guchian's Devil in the Dance Hall. The devil has all the best tunes, doesn't he? In the Countrywide Big Band this week, Harry Buchtas pushed back the furniture, Amandine Paso Devine kept time, and Tessa Delahanty called the tune. We'll talk to you at the same time again next week. Until then, have a good weekend.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.